Oh, shit, boy.
Somebody on a dialysis machine in a cave didn't have NORAD stand down, didn't do war games of flying planes in the buildings that morning, didn't do CIA insider trading, didn't call Merrill Lee Brown and tell him not to fly, and Ashcroft and everybody else.
Yo. What really happened on September 11th when 3,000 citizens were sent into heaven? Why the era fake Bin Laden video confession? Why's the fairy tale version got so many questions? We're radical hijackers that were only using box cutters, sliced up pilots like a knife cutting hot butter. They had us frantic like a NASDAQ stock runner. They flew in planes like a Tom Cruise top gunner. But the story's bogus, I noticed. Dick Cheney ran out of living, drinking Diet Sprite sodas. You only gotta look at how the buildings collapsed. Bombs popping off, listen, cause I'm building effects. A controlled demolition had a molten pool of steel up at ground zero. That's the temperature to drown heroes. Spies in the buildings that were oxygen starved. People waving from the windows where the bombing had started. So let me get this straight. These fires couldn't melt people of glass, but they could melt 47 steel frames. World Trade 7 wasn't hit by a plane, and 5 p.m. collapsed, and they couldn't explain. Now for the third time in history, a steel building melted in a neat little pile. Had it happened, such a mystery. The owners said pull it and admitted they knew. That's Larry Silverstein, the partner with the Blackstone Group. They got the act all cool and made $6 billion, stacking blood money dripping off of necktie collars. The South Tower burned for like 48 minutes, while the buildings in Madrid burned for 28 hours, shooting white hot flames, but they never collapsed. Ask your scientist professor, make him try and explain that. But just watch the videos with concrete shooting out the blast point.
9/11 was an inside job by Roy Shivers. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. You can go to kkrn.org, click on the listen button, and you'll be listening to us over the internet. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. Your support keeps us on the air, so I encourage you to go to KKRN and hit the donate button and try to support us that way. I want to thank all of those people that supported us last week. We had a very successful fundraising drive, which means we must be doing something right, and the community appreciates us, and we appreciate the community, and we'll try to serve you in the best way we can. You can reach me personally at unspun@kkrn.org if you'd like to leave me a little message there. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Today, our guest on the phone is Christopher Bolin. He is a 9/11 truth activist, and he has been challenging the official story of the events of 9/11 for a dozen years. According to his bio, Christopher Bolin is an American journalist from Schaumburg Township, Illinois, who has investigated the events of 9/11 since 2001. In 2005 and 2006, he helped Professor Stephen E. Jones, who found evidence of an explosive form of superthermite in the dust of the demolished Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Dr. Jones and a team of scientists later published a peer-reviewed paper on this crucial discovery that disproves the government version of what caused the towers to fall. In August of 2006, Bolin was was attacked in his home in Hoffman Estates in Illinois by a heavily armed three-man squad of undercover police, which he had been seen prowling around his house for several days, and called 911 to report. The results of the police assault was that Bolin was falsely charged with assault and resisting arrest, both misdemeanor charges, end quote. After failing to have a fair trial at the Cook County Court, and rather than allow the repression of his work, Bolin made the decision to move his family to Europe in June of 2007. There he began working on two books on 9/11. They are Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. He is currently living in Scandinavia. He is currently, well, he's still there, and he's on the phone with us. And you'll find most of his work and other interviews at his website at www.bolin, that's bolin.com, www.bolin.com. Chris, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Yeah, hello, Doug. Nice to be with you.
Oh, great to have you. I want to thank you for calling in and being with us today. You have you've spent the last dozen years of your life dealing with some very important facts and some questions that a lot of people have about 9/11. I wanted to kind of do a little prologue here. First of all, I want people to understand where we're coming in from and where I'm coming from, because so many people immediately when they hear questions about 9/11 think 9/11 conspiracy. So I just want to enumerate a few points. First of all, number one, I am not a conspiracy theorist that believes every rumor or crackpot utterance that is planted on the internet. Number two, I have a background in chemistry, physics, math, computer science, and linguistics. I was an Air Force intelligence from 1965 to 1969. Number three, anybody that knows me knows that I question just about everything, and I do my own research on issues that we discuss on the show. That said, I have questioned the official story of 9/11 from day one. The lack of any meaningful investigation by our government and the lies by our government since that event only leads me to believe that most of the information we have gotten about 9/11 and the wars of occupation and regime change since then have been deceptions to serve other goals. The reason I have invited Chris on the show, and he has graciously accepted, is to answer questions and address doubts many of us have and have had for years now about the events of 9/11. So let's get down to it. My first doubts of the official story occurred as I was watching the events unfold live that morning. I had been on a flight crew in the Air Force for several years, and I kept asking aloud, where are the fighter interceptors? I asked that numerous times, and I couldn't just grasp why they weren't there over such a great period of time. They should have been in the air and intercepted these airliners. So let's, if you would like to, I just given us a place to start. So, Chris, maybe you can kind of give us some insight into how your doubts started and maybe address the one that I had originally. Where were the fighter interceptors on that morning?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good place to start. I addressed that in my book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and the other book, The Original Articles, because it's very important to understand that as 9/11 unfolded, as the real emergency unfolded on September 11th, 2001, there were military drills going on, military exercises being done by NORAD, for example, in which there were false inputs on the computer screens of the air traffic controllers that were the people, the first responders, if you will, who should have responded to the FAA and to the military, that there were these rogue planes. And the problem is that there was computer trickery going on. There were two companies, that basically PTEC, a small Israeli-run company in Quincy, Massachusetts, and MITRE Corporation, which is basically the brains for the Air Force. These two companies had worked very closely together in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11 to deal with how the responses would be in a case of emergency like this. And what happened on 9/11 is that those responses were thwarted because people knew how the connections would work and where those connections could be muddled with in order to thwart the effective military response. And so there was computer trickery going on, and there were the air traffic controllers, most specifically in Rome, New York, at NEAD, Northeast Air Defense System. These people had a whole bunch of false inputs on their computer screens, so they didn't really know what was real and what was fake as the emergency was unfolding.
And so, therefore, there was they didn't call the fighters up into the air to intercept bogey inputs that they were getting on the screen, huh?
Well, no, it's not that they, no, there were fighters sent, for example, from Otis Air Force Base in near Cape Cod, And those fighter jets should have been in the area, in the vicinity of the World Trade Center, several minutes before the second plane struck, but they weren't. And this is a problem that, NORAD, when NORAD testified, when the people from NORAD testified about this response from Otis Air Force Base, for example, they gave three different versions of how fast these jets were going and why they failed to reach their destination. But the thing is that the whole NORAD, the NORAD exercise, Vigilant Guardian, that's what it was called, involved fighter jets coming from, you know, bombers coming across from Canada, and there was also a computer scenario game going on, or a military drill going on, in which there were actually hijacked airplanes in the sky. So this was a confusion of reality versus the drill. That's the first thing. But then NORAD itself was under the command in Colorado of two Canadian commanders. There was two Canadian commanders who were the point men. One was named Jelenic, and I forgot the other guy's name. So, you know, how the NORAD drill confused the response, the military response, is still an unanswered question, because the NORAD responses are still being kept secret, if you will. They're not talking about it. I've tried to contact these commanders, and they don't want to talk about it at all, the Canadian commanders.
And my understanding is, and I'm just remembering back, because I was so intensively watching the news at that time, but also somehow the FAA's tapes of all of those events that the air traffic controllers and the NORAD people, their interactions, somehow those tapes were lost. Am I right there?
Yeah, they were destroyed. They were destroyed. A lot of the key tapes regarding the air traffic controllers and the FAA response and things like that, there's one fellow who took those tapes and the discs and broke them into little pieces and then distributed them into different garbage cans around the place. I mean, there was a very concerted effort to destroy the evidence regarding the response of the air traffic controllers and the tapes of what was going on between the FAA, air traffic controllers, and the military. This whole response and the failure of the military to respond effectively to this hijacking reality is still something that's kept very secret.
I'm just trying to figure out who would be giving these orders and why the purposeful destruction of evidence. Who is in a position to order something like that?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that's what I do in my book. You know, like I look at, people have to remember, first of all, that 9/11, all aspects of 9/11, basically remained uninvestigated. They were, the crime was not investigated by the FBI properly, as it should have been. The FBI was under the command of a new director,
Robert Mueller,
who had only been on the job for like 6 days prior to 9/11. But the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. It works under the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, and its job on 9/11 was post 9/11 was to collect and gather the evidence and analyze the evidence to prosecute in order to help the prosecution of the guilty parties. And the prosecution was being done by the Assistant Attorney General at the time. His name is Michael Chertoff. He happens to be an Israeli national and the son of a Mossad agent. But he is the person who was supposed to prosecute the crimes of 9/11. There was no prosecution, if you remember, because there was also no investigation. The FBI, rather than investigating the evidence from the crime scene, they basically oversaw the destruction of the evidence from the crime scene, whether you're talking about the videotapes or the steal from the World Trade Center, or, as you just said, the tapes from the FAA and the military. All of this stuff belonged to the FBI investigation. And anybody who destroyed evidence is committing a crime.
Yeah, but who would prosecute them? And let me play the devil's advocate here. You said there was no investigation, but we did have the 9/11 commission. And what about their investigation? And of course, they put out a book, the 9/11 commission report. I forget how many pages, 300 or 400 pages. I couldn't find it yesterday. I was searching around in my library. But what about that investigation?
Well, that was not an investigation. That was a politically appointed committee headed by Lee Hamilton and Governor Dean. I think his name is from Massachusetts or New Jersey, something like that. It was a politically appointed committee, and these people were given the 9/11 Commission was directed by a guy named Zelikow, Phil Zelikow. And what Phil Zelikow, his specialty at university was basically how to create myth, creating myth, a modern myth. And this is what he did with the 9/11 Commission. He basically had the complete outline of where the commission was going to go before anybody met or anybody spoke to the committee. And he had overall authority of, the evidence and all of this. And so what you have is a politically appointed committee that was working to basically validate the government's version of events and not look at anything outside of that. For example, this war game scenario I told you about, Vigilant Guardian, is not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission except in a footnote. So it's like very important things like the explosions, the evidence of explosions at the World Trade Center. There were something like 120 eyewitnesses that saw or felt explosions before and during the demolition of the World Trade Center. But that wasn't discussed in the 9/11 Commission, nor was it discussed in the building studies that were done, the building studies of the Twin Towers, or the building studies of the Pentagon, or the building studies of the Building Number 7. So all of these investigations, so-called investigations, engineering studies, the FEMA studies, and the 9/11 Commission report you talked about, all together, they do not substitute for a proper forensic investigation, a criminal investigation that should have been done from day one. And rather than being done, the evidence was destroyed, the steel was taken from the World Trade Center, cut up into little pieces, and sent to China where it was melted down. That's destruction of evidence.
And you mentioned Zelikow, and another thing I know about Zelikow is that he was actually working under Condi Rice in the Bush administration before he oversaw the 9/11 Commission. And so his credentials are not exactly untainted.
And you remember that they didn't even start. Bush and Cheney were adamantly opposed to any sort of blue ribbon investigation, and they dallied on that 9/11 commission for over a year, I think. So it's like the what had to be done, what wasn't done, what had to be done is a criminal investigation. You can have all the little political committees you want. You can have all these politically appointed groups looking up this tree and that tree. But what you really need to have in such a crime. Mass murder is the largest, crime of mass murder terrorism in American history. And rather than investigating the crime, the Department of Justice and the FBI allowed for the steel, which was basically all that was left from the World Trade Center. All that was really left was steel and dust. A lot of people don't realize that, but bodies were basically non-existent. The bodies of over 1,000 people are gone. And the computers and a lot of these things just disappeared. But they were lucky; they were able to find some hard drives and had some hard drives looked at. But so much stuff was destroyed because the buildings were pulverized. So all that you had left was steel and dust. And so those two elements of the remains of the evidence, those had to be analyzed first, by criminal investigators, and that's where they failed.
Yeah, there. I remember seeing some pictures early on. Some people had tried to capture some pictures of the steel. They were in a holding yard in New Jersey, and they showed them kind of all cut on a 45-degree angle, which apparently is a technique used when there's demolition done. Is that what you understand, or what is your understanding also? And what about the dust? What is there that's incriminating, and what does the dust that's been analyzed show?
Okay, that's very good. Let's start with the dust, because the dust was analyzed in some papers. There were some papers done for the U.S. Geological Survey, and they published a little booklet of these papers. It's a study of the dust from the World Trade Center. And in this book, there were some very interesting micrographs. That's a photograph of little tiny droplets of iron-rich spheres. These are little tiny balls, little tiny steel balls, basically, iron balls. And these are perfectly round. And these are found in a great, great abundance in the dust of the World Trade Center. Well, the first thing you say is, how did this steel or this iron, you know, become molten, and then form these little droplets? What this means is that there was a great amount of molten steel, molten iron, more precisely, that accompanied the destruction of the World Trade Center. That means that those huge clouds that rolled through lower Manhattan were very hot, because inside those clouds there were billions and billions of tiny molten balls of steel, which, as they went through the air, they cooled off and they hardened and they formed these tiny, 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 you know, we're talking like a tenth of a millimeter in size and you know, smaller than 1 millimeter in size. These are like much smaller than BBs. But that's where a lot of the steel went. That's where a lot of iron went. And what that indicates is that there were temperatures hotter than the melting point of iron and in the destruction of the World Trade Center. Well, that's not possible given the government explanation airplane fuel and these fires caused the collapse of the World Trade Center. There's nothing that could account for such high temperatures to produce molten iron. This is where, when I brought this information to Professor Jones, I was at UC Davis, I took this information from the study back to Provo. Professor Jones looked at it, and this matched with what we knew about the large amount of molten steel, molten iron, that was found in the basement of the World Trade Center. I mean, we're talking like weeks and weeks when after 9/11, when they finally got down to the bottom of the pile, when they got down to the bedrock of Manhattan, they found pools of molten iron still in the molten state. Well, you see, that's not a normal fire. What that is, that's a chemical reaction. Something is going on that's producing incredibly hot temperatures and causing molten iron. Well, that's thermite. That's thermite. That's what thermite does. And so,
okay, would you explain for listeners what thermite is?
Yeah, thermite is an old invention from Germany. Hans Goldschmidt invented it a long time ago, and it's a combination of aluminum oxide, no, ferrous oxide, iron oxide, and aluminum particles. And usually these particles are in the granular size, and so when it's an incendiary at that point. So that, for example, when they weld railroad tracks together, they have a little coupler that has thermite in it, and they cause this reaction. It's called aluminothermic reaction because it's an aluminum reaction which produces a lot of heat and molten iron. And so when they put the rails together, they have this little thermite coupling that causes a reaction. And the steel rails are welded together in one piece. This is very common in Europe. But the thing is that when you take this thermite and this aluminum and iron oxide, and when you add a few other chemicals to it like sulfur or barium or things like that, you can create incendiary effects, different effects. It becomes thermate. It'll react a little bit differently. Maybe create more flame. It can go off at a lower temperature, what have you. But this is the kind of thing that we found in the dust of the World Trade Center. And what they found, Professor Jones found, is that he found thermetic material that was produced at the nano level. That means that it's almost at the molecular level. So instead of having grains of sand size, you know, combination, you have something that's combining at the molecular level, so that the reaction is infinitesimally more intense, hotter, and explosive, because it's happening at a nano. It's happening at that molecular level.
Let me remind the listeners: you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Christopher Bolin, journalist, researcher, and 9/11 truth advocate. We're discussing the events of 9/11 and the implication of the evidence, or the lack thereof, of the evidence from that day. So. call in if you've got questions for Christopher about 9/11 and the truth of 9/11. Our number is 337-1885. That's the 530 area code, 337-1885. Well, I know that there are other organizations. One of them, I think, is some architects and engineers around the world that have questioned the very concept that you're pointing out. The evidence shows here that the towers could not have come down from the fuel from the planes, and a fire like that, especially one that was not burning cleanly and hot. It was more or less a smothered out kind of fire that would have never produced those heats. So what do the engineers kind of concur with what you're pointing out here?
Yeah, the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth are another great institution that started in Northern California, I think, Richard Gage in San Francisco. The Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth do an excellent case of presenting the scientific engineering explanation and data to prove that the government version is not correct. They have like 9/11 explosive evidence. Experts speak out. That's a DVD, and they have many products, many great newspapers—not newspapers, but pamphlets and DVDs—and that's very good for the. For the layman or the person who's interested in what happened on 9/11, it's very good to go to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and look at what these architects and engineers say. And there's 2,500 of them or something like that, the latest count, that have signed on to this. They're calling for a new investigation. They don't go and point fingers at who they might think be behind it. They have my books. I sent my books to them a long time ago. But they look at it from a technical point of view. From an architecture and engineering's point of view, that this could not have happened. It is not possible for it to have happened like the government says it happened. So basically what they're doing is they're showing you the evidence that the government has lied to us, and the media has lied as well, because the media has an obligation in a free society like ours, in democracy, the media has an obligation to do its own investigation, especially when the evidence indicates that the government is lying. And in this respect, both our government and our so-called free press have both utterly betrayed us.
Yes, and I would agree wholeheartedly with that. Mainstream media not only sold us the stories about 9/11, and the government, of course, was, those little leaked conversations, and, of course, Dick Cheney immediately, along with several other people in the Bush administration, coming out and trying to get others to blame Saddam Hussein, another myth that was created at that same time. And I think polls show that something like 60-something percent of the people still believe that lie, that somehow Iraq and Saddam Hussein was involved with 9/11. So, and this brings us to I think another important question: the neocons, the neoconservatives that were there before the Bush administration even got into office, and of course it's pretty well recognized that their intent from the moment or before they got into office was to attack Iraq, and but I'll just mention the term, and maybe you can expound on a little bit more, but the neocons needed a new Pearl Harbor in order to put their plans into play. Maybe you could tell the listeners a little more about that side of this coin.
Yeah. Well, as you said, the neocons under these institutions like the Project for a New American Century, headed by these Jewish neocons like the Kagan family, father and sons, and they had this document, preparing America's defenses for the new century or something like that.
Yeah,
for the Project for the New American Century, PNAC. And that document from the year 2000, I think it was, it was signed by people like Cheney and Wolfowitz. These people were all part of it. Basically said that the United States had to invade Iraq, and they had to overthrow the government of of Iraq. There had to be regime change in Iraq. That had to happen. And you know, even if Saddam Hussein were to be a wonderful guy from today on, they said still we would have to go in there and replace him and change the government. And that's what they did. And if you remember in those presidential debates that preceded the election of 2000, this was one of the questions that astute journalists were asking, and people were asking the Bush administration, you know, if you're elected, will you begin a policy of regime change in the Middle East? And you know, this is exactly because they knew this was coming. So this document, as I said, you know, as you said, was already in circulation, and this group had already made these calls. And it wasn't new. I mean, they had been pushing on Clinton to do the same thing. One has to understand from the Palestinian point of view, from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict point of view, is that Saddam Hussein was supporting the Palestinian uprising, the Intifada. And what he was doing was he was giving $25,000 to the families of suicide bombers, Palestinian suicide bombers. So in that respect, he was actually kind of like encouraging Palestinian terrorism, because $25,000 for a poor family from Gaza, you know, is a lot of money. And so a lot of young men were making themselves into suicide bombers in order to get this $25,000 from Saddam Hussein to their families. And you know, of course, the regime of Saddam Hussein was very, it was strongly opposed to what the Israelis are doing. And the Israelis saw Iraq as being one of their biggest enemies. And, you know, getting Saddam Hussein and occupying that country and having the regime changed was one of their high priorities. You know, so that's one of the main reasons why we went in there, because the neocons, it wasn't the oil. It's not just the oil. The oil is just like a bonus. But the changing the Iraqi regime to something like it is today, completely chaotic, is what the Israelis actually desired.
And the result, a lot of people don't realize the result of the invasion of Iraq was the destruction of a more secular regime, even though he might have been a brutal dictator. Everybody was treated the same, more or less. I mean, there were the favored Ba'ath Party, probably Sunni. But what we've done now in the Middle East, and it looks like that's part of the overall plan, is to have the Sunnis and the Shiites kill each other.
Right.
You know, that's Saudi Arabia is basically Sunni, and Osama bin Laden was a Saudi Arabian Wahhabi, which is a Sunni fundamentalist. And a lot of people don't put all this together and understand that what we're really doing there is creating secular wars between the different factions of the Islamic religion.
That's the plan. That's the plan. There was an Israeli strategic planner called Oded Yinon, Y-I-N-O-N, Oded Yinon. He wrote this plan in 1982, I think it was. It's called The Balkanization of the Middle East. And it's available online. You can find it. But the Israeli strategy for these countries surrounding them and in the Middle East is basically to foment this sectarian divide, like you said, between different ethnic groups and religious groups, so that you break up the bigger countries into smaller ethnic statelets. It's called Balkanization because what they did, it's exactly what they did in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was a large secular socialist country with different groups in there, but, you know, religious confessions and some different ethnic groups. And today it's like a country of seven, or it's a region of seven states, little statelets, all of which are poorer, all of which are weaker than they were before when they were part of Yugoslavia. So this is what they want to do, is that by breaking up these Yugoslavia, Syria, Libya, all these countries, by causing this chaos and this sectarian struggles like we have today in Iraq, they hope to break the countries into smaller pieces, into, you know, two or three countries.
These are also the other common factor. These are also countries that were not bowing to Wall Street and free market capitalist system. They were not putting themselves under that under their control, they were also talking about the dollar going away from the American petrodollar and embracing the euro in their oil sales. Yeah. Is that, do you think that's a factor, or that's the one other common denominator I see going after Syria and Iran and Iraq?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They want to have these countries as docile client states, and they want them to be weaker and countries that will, basically accept the dictate from the International Monetary Fund and the Wall Street and the World Bank and everything, They want weak little client states that won't say no and will basically, turn over their valuable natural resources, for pennies.
Yeah, and Alan Greenspan, it was interesting in his book, he was surprised when anybody thought that the invasion of Iraq was about anything other than oil.
Present that. There were a lot of people who wanted to present the invasion of Iraq as being solely about oil, because, of course, Iraq has lots and lots of oil. But as I said, that's not the only reason, and probably not the first reason. Because the strategic question in the whole Middle East is they want to neutralize Soviet Union's influence there, like in Syria. They want to weaken Iran. Iran is like the most important country there. And they want to basically dominate and control the whole region and let Israel be the most powerful state in the region. And that's what they're trying to accomplish.
And let me one more time remind the listeners, this is Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Christopher Boleyn is with us. He's a journalist, researcher, 9/11 truth advocate, and we're discussing the events of 9/11 and what the implications of the real evidence show. So call us, 337-1885, 337-1885. If you have any questions for Christopher, please call in. I don't want to get into an Israeli bashing here, but I think we need to delve into this side of the question, because the Israelis appear to be, from your writings and your research, appear to be central to the whole 9/11 events. And if we consider that the story, and let's just throw out the Osama bin Laden and 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia and Yemen somehow took down the World Trade Towers let's just put that aside and let's consider what the other implications are and why you consider Israel to be one of the primary actors in the events of 9/11. And maybe we can start with the history, because a lot of people don't know Israel's history. They have a pretty violent and subversive histories. So if you'd talk to that for a little bit, and then maybe we'll get into why you make those connections with 9/11.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that my degree is actually in Middle Eastern history. I studied the history of Israel and Palestine, and I've spent a lot of time there. And the thing is that Israel as a nation is pretty young. It was created in 1948, and it was created, through a war of in which the Israeli forces, the Jewish forces, destroyed something like 400 Palestinian cities and villages and ethnically cleansed as much as they could Palestine of Palestinians. And this was caused by a lot of massacres and a lot of things of that nature that were used as terrorism to scare the Palestinians into fleeing. And it succeeded. They kicked out a lot of Palestinians into these refugee camps where they have languished until today in Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, what have you. The thing is that this was done by these radical Zionist terrorist groups that were created in the 30s and 40s. One is called Etzel, the Irgun, I-R-G-U-N. That was headed by Menachem Begin. And they did things like they blew up a hotel in Jerusalem called the King David Hotel in 1946 and killed 90 people because the British had collected evidence of Zionist crimes that implicated people like the Jewish Agency, you know, big group of a Zionist group in terrorism. And so a lot of people would have been hanged, and a lot of people would have been, you know, put into court if this investigation had gone forward. And so what the Irgun and the Haganah did is that they went and blew up the hotel, because that was headquarters for the British mandate, for the British forces in Palestine. And by blowing up the hotel, they destroyed a lot of evidence, which is very similar to what happened on 9/11. But these groups, these terrorist groups like the Irgun, there was another called the Stern Gang or Lehi, these groups, after the creation of the State of Israel, were kind of like in opposition. They were in the opposition against the Labor Party. But in 1973, they created a group. These terrorist groups created a coalition, political coalition called the Likud. The Likud, L-I-K-U-D, that is the party that controls Israel today. And this is a party that was created by terrorists, people who used terrorism to achieve their strategic goal. This party has been in power in Israel since the late 1970s. And remember, this was people like Menachem Begin, who was prime minister, and Yitzhak Shamir. These were two of the old generation terrorists.
Let me interrupt you, Chris. And we have a caller, and I want to. He's been waiting a few minutes, so let me take this call, and then we'll come back to that Israeli history. Randy, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, my question is, you know, this is kind of unrelated to the technical mechanics of the what brought the towers down. But you know, this is something that I heard, you know, or read about. There's a large group of people that never showed up for work on that day when the towers fell down. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good question.
Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's where I usually start, because he's talking about the 4,000 Israelis who did not go to work at the World Trade Center on 9/11. And people would, in the beginning, people would say, oh, this is Arab propaganda, this is, you know, anti-Semitic and all that. But actually, this report originated with the Jerusalem Post online. They posted an article about this, and their information was based on the number of people who had called to the Israeli Foreign Ministry asking about their loved one who was supposed to be at work on 9/11 at the World Trade Center. And this accounted to be 4,000 Israelis who should have been at work, but none of them died at the World Trade Center. Because there was an instant messaging service by an Israeli company called Odigo, O-D-I-G-O. And this company, which had offices in New York City, close to the World Trade Center, and in Israel, this instant messaging system worked on all various platforms. So you could get the message through your email, through your cell phone, through your BlackBerry, through your pager, what have you. The message went out basically in Hebrew, that don't go to work today, that there's going to be a terrible catastrophe at the World Trade Center. And Alex Diamandis, the vice president of the company, told the FBI that the warning was precise to the minute. And you see, in this way, these Israeli Hebrew-speaking people who should have been at the World Trade Center got this message like at 6 o'clock in the morning, said, don't go to work today, don't go anywhere near the World Trade Center. At 8:45, there's going to be a terrible event. And they were spared. But this is one of the big. This is one of the best documented sources of Israeli prior knowledge. And this Israeli prior knowledge, when you have prior knowledge of an event like 9/11, it indicates complicity in the crime.
I remember that morning. Now, this could be explained another way, because, and I'm playing the devil's advocate here. There was somebody from British intelligence, and I don't remember if it was CBS or NBC. It was one of those I was watching, and they had a quick interview with him, and he said, I mean, this is while all this was unfolding, he said, well, many people knew, he said, the British intelligence had warned American intelligence, and that also, he said it that in that same sentence or paragraph, that also the Israelis had been warning the U.S. about this attack. So would that be a good enough explanation, do you think, of why so many other Israelis didn't go in?
No, that's just like general ballpark warnings, you know. There were a lot of warnings like that you know, some terrorists could do something awful, you know, maybe in September, maybe in August. No, those are general warnings, and there were plenty of those. But a specific warning given on the morning of September 11th, warning people that there would be a bomb or a bombing of the World Trade Center that was precise to the minute. Such a warning is specific knowledge of the time of the attack on the day of the attack. Now, you know, if these 4,000 Israelis had got this message, if they had any ethics or morals, they would have gotten on the phone and called the New York police and the New York Fire Department and told people to evacuate the buildings, right? You know, starting at 8 o'clock. Yeah. If they had evacuated the buildings at 8 o'clock, you know, nobody would have been killed. But those poor people that were trapped, you know, in those buildings, some 3,000 people died in those buildings. And you have to understand that those people were blown up inside of the buildings. This is an old Israeli trick. This is what they did in 1948. This is what they did. This is what Ariel Sharon used to do. They would put people in a building and then blow it up. This is what they did in Gaza in 2006. They put all the members of one family in a house and then blew it up. I mean, this is just beyond obscene.
Well, let's get back to Israeli history, because I think we make these statements about what Israel does, but and I know there's plenty of them documented, and there's a lot on your site, and there's a lot all around the world if you care to check. There's plenty of research has been done on this. The one I'm familiar with is the attack on the USS Liberty. I think that was, what, in 1968 or 67? Maybe you could tell people about that.
Yeah, well, in 67, that during the so-called Six-Day War in June of 67, the Israelis attacked an American ship, basically like an NSA ship, a spy ship, that was in international waters off the coast of Gaza and Egypt down there. And the Israelis attacked it with these Mirage jets, and then they sent out a torpedo boat. And the communications that they were giving back and forth have been declassified. And it shows that the Israelis knew that this was an American vessel and that they went ahead and attacked it. And not only did they attack it, they wanted to sink it with all hands lost. So when the torpedo hit the boat, it killed something like 34 Americans in one fell swoop. But then when these remaining people were trying to get off the ship was just pounded with missiles and guns and everything. When people tried to get off the ship into the life rafts, the Israelis machine gunned the life rafts. If you read the captain's, the skipper's book, his name is Ennis, James Ennis, Assault on the Liberty, you know, it makes your blood boil because it was such a cold-blooded attack. The Israelis wanted to put that ship on the bottom of the sea and then blame Egypt. And in so doing, the American public would be swayed, you know, by a false flag terror attack like 9/11 to then go against Egypt, which is what they wanted to do. This is Israel's. This is what they do: false flag terrorism and deception. Because by deception, they're able to take a big country like the United States and basically fool the people into fighting their wars for them.
And of course, that's exactly what has happened after 9/11. What indications do we have of direct Israeli participation in the events of 9/11?
Well, there's in the events of 9/11, it's a little bit difficult. There's in the preparation of the 9/11, in the crime itself, there's some, and in the cover up that followed. But let me start from the end, from the cover up that followed. As I pointed out before, the Assistant Attorney General, Michael Chertoff, is an Israeli national. He's an Israeli dual national. And he's the person who oversaw the destruction of evidence. Now, the destruction of evidence and the prosecution of the crimes that didn't happen, that's very key, because if you commit a false flag terror attack, the last thing you want is a proper forensic investigation, because a proper forensic investigation will reveal exactly what happened to those buildings. They didn't want that to happen. They didn't want that nanothermite to be discovered. So it's when Professor Jones discovered the nanothermite, that's what got us into a lot of trouble. That's when I was attacked by undercover police. That's when Professor Jones was attacked and removed from his position as a teacher at BYU. Because we were not supposed, this was not a discovery that was not supposed to happen. Okay? Now, in the lead up prior to 9/11, there was this company, an Israeli company, headed by a senior Mossad man, Shaul Eisenberg. He's Mr. China. He's the big Asian boss of the Mossad. He's passed away now, I think. He had a little company that tried to get the security contract for the World Trade Center back in 1987, I think it was. and his company was called Atwell Security. And the people who were trying to get this contract from the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey were these old Israeli Mossad agents who went after Eichmann, for example, who kidnapped Eichmann in Argentina. Or these are the same guys who stole the plutonium from the factory in Pennsylvania and took it to Israel for their nuclear bombs. These are people like Zvi Malkin and Shalom Ben-Dor. These are their names. But if you, in my book, you can read a lot about it, because this was when Israel first, when the Mossad first tried to get the security contract for the World Trade Center. And in 1979, the former head of the Mossad had predicted to an American Zionist that the Arabs would attack the tallest building in New York City. He was asked, will terrorism ever come to America? And he said, yes, it will. They will attack your tallest building in New York City because that's a big phallic symbol or something like that. A bunch of nonsense. But he made that prediction in 1979. And so you see, the Israelis were trying to get the security contract for the World Trade Center already in the early 80s, because that is how you have to stage such a crime. In order to stage such a big crime, you have to have all your bases covered. You have to know exactly, you have to run the security, you have to run the surveillance, you have to run the investigation, you have to run the prosecution, all of these things. And that's where we see Israeli influence at every single point. In my book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, you can read that at every critical point of the 9/11, what I call the 9/11 saga, you have an Israeli Zionist or an Israeli agent or an American Zionist working for the State of Israel. And they're not just working for the State of Israel, they're working for, again, as I said, the Likud Party, which is basically a party of terrorists. And these are people who use terrorism to achieve their strategic goals. And that's what they did on 9/11. They used Israeli-engineered terrorism to scare Americans, to shock and awe Americans into basically accepting the Israeli view of the world. And unfortunately, for the last 12 years, that's where Americans have been trapped.
Yeah, and their inability to even challenge the official story, especially the mainstream media. And I'm sure there's some people listening now that are going to say, oh, more 9/11 conspiracy theory. But I don't think we haven't talked about any conspiracy theory here other than the government conspiracy and the media conspiracy, which is pretty apparent. And if we need further proof, I mean, we have the crimes of the Bush administration, not only in Guantanamo and, of course, against the Geneva Conventions, and the crimes of starting a war of aggression. And, it is pretty apparent that the U.S. has kind of followed the lead of Israel. Now we're assassinating people with drone programs, and we're spreading lies and deception to try to get another front opened up in Syria, where we can bomb that poor regime in that country into oblivion, much like we did in Libya. So I guess the reason I'm bringing this up is I don't see they have us pretty much right where they want us. And until the American people wake up, what is going to change this? Do you see a way that this is going to change, any way that we can get past the control of the media and the control of the supposed governmental facts? How do we get around this? How does America recover?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the American public has shown a lot of resilience, especially when they tried to get us into this war with Syria. When Obama tried to take us into war with Syria based on this use of chemical gas, the allegations about that, the American people stood up and really said, no, we don't want any more of this. So it shows that the American people have had enough of this war based on allegations. They've had enough of this Middle Eastern conflict, and they understand, the dangers of getting into a war with Syria, which would bring in Iran and Russia, what have you. But it's the media. If the media were not controlled, if the media were, I say, Zionist controlled, if the media were to look at the questions and look at the evidence of 9/11, then the American people would you know, the shutters would fall from their eyes, the blinders would fall from their eyes overnight. And if CNN would start, you know, bringing out some evidence, or the New York Times, if they would start bringing out the 9/11 truth, the facts, then the people would wake up. Because, you see, unfortunately, so many people in America still have a bad TV habit, or they have this habit of reading the mainstream media and believing it. Because, you know, Americans believe they have a free press, and they think that this is the truth. Well, unfortunately, that's not the case. The media has been lying to them. You know, like the New York Times, they published articles telling the American population that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, these came from Ahmed Chalabi through mm-hmm. Judith Miller, and these were absolute lies, fabrications. And these are the fabrications that America went to war in Iraq for. And look at how much damage that did to our nation. How many young Americans died? How many Iraqi people got killed? We destroyed a nation. I mean, why is the New York Times not put on trial for its role in conspiring and creating a war of aggression? The war in Iraq is, without a doubt, a war of aggression. That means people like Cheney and Bush and Judith Miller and all these neocons that planned to prepare this war, they should get the same treatment as the guys got in Nuremberg in 1949. You know, this is an American law, the Nuremberg Charter. Planning a war of aggression is the most severe war crime that one can commit.
Yeah, I agree. And, of course, the New York Times were complicit in the cover-up of Bush and his wiretapping and other surveillance. And we see it again and again, you know, with the NSA. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left. And I wanted to get into the fact, because you are an expatriate, and do you see any hope of coming home, or do you actually want to come back to America? If I were you, I might consider staying where I was at.
Well, I've been out of the country for 6 years. I want very much to come to the West Coast, actually, this winter. I'm invited to San Diego. I'm also invited to speak in Iran. But I think that in the new year, in January, I hope to come to the West Coast and give some speeches up and down, you know, between Seattle and San Diego, because the West Coast is actually the most alert, most politically awake part of the nation, I think. And so I want to do that. America, the dire straits that we're in right now today, economically, politically, and every other thing, are due to the deception of 9/11. That's most important. If you want to understand how all this has happened to us, how we've been fleeced, how we've been defrauded, you have to understand how we've been lied to about 9/11. Because that's the mother load of this whole thing, and finding out who's behind that, finding out who's behind 9/11. That's why Solving 9/11, my book, is really important, because once people read that, once people understand the facts, and all those facts in there are verifiable. I'm not saying anything based on my own account. All the information I put in my books is verifiable, as it should be, so people can judge for themselves who's telling the truth and who's not.
Well, we only have a little over a minute, maybe two, and I want to thank you, you know, for your research and for being on Unspun and Experiment and Truth Telling with me today. And I want to invite you back. Would you come back? And because we've just kind of touched the surface of this, and I know that you've done a lot more research.
Want to do it next Saturday?
Well, okay, let's do it. We'll do it next Saturday. We'll continue this discussion, and I think we can use this show to promote, and we'll get a little bit more listenership, too, because it's just so important that we have this discussion in America. This is the elephant sitting on top of the 500-pound gorilla. This is really an important question, and if anybody that believes our government at this point, after a dozen years of lying or more, and doesn't want to look at the evidence that we do have, and hopefully we can open up an investigation to this unsolved crime, as you call it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I hear our fade-out music. That means we have a minute. So thank you once again. We've been talking to Christopher. Oh, so you got an ovation here in the studio.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to continuing this next Saturday here on Unspun. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Doug.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Next up on KKRN is Peace Talks Radio. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week for more with Christopher Bolin. You can go to www.bolin.com and do a little of your own research. Thank you all for listening. Next up, Peace Talks Radio.